Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
Mr. Nadler?
Aye.
Mr. Nadler votes aye. Ms. Lofgren?
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye. Ms. Jackson Lee?
Aye.
Ms. Jackson Lee votes aye.
Impeachment takes a major step forward. After a week of contentious debate, the House Judiciary Committee approved two articles of impeachment against President Trump, sending the charges to the full House for a vote. My guest, Kimberly Whaley, is professor of law at the University of Baltimore. She's author of the recent book, How to Read the Constitution and Why. I asked her to break down the charges against the president and what happens next in the process. Professor Whaley, it's good to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Diane.
So now the vote has been taken, straight party line vote on two articles of impeachment. Explain the first article, abuse of power, so that we all understand the same thing and how it relates to our Constitution.
The first article, abuse of power, alleges that the president used the massive power of his office for his own personal gain and not for the benefit of the American people. The idea really is the presidency is almost like a fiduciary. The person who occupies that office doesn't have some inherent power like a monarch would in, you know, medieval England. That power came from God, essentially. The American president's power comes from the people. And so if he uses that power in a way that's not beneficial to the people, but to himself, that is an abuse of power. And here the allegation is that he asked President Zelensky, Ukrainian President Zelensky, for announcements of investigations into Joe Biden and his son. And in exchange for that, or basically as leverage to get that statement, that public statement, he withheld $391 million in military aid that the Senate had authorized and that was necessary for Ukraine to basically stave off Russian aggression. Ukraine has been in a civil war with Russia. And in 2013, Russia actually invaded Ukraine, a part of Ukraine called Crimea. And so it's in America's interest to promote democracy, to foster Ukrainian independence from Russia. And withholding that money hurt Ukraine. It helped Russia, hurt Ukraine. And by virtue of hurting Ukraine, it hurt America's interests. So there is the abuse of power. Using that ability to tell OMB to hold up the money and also withhold a White House meeting and in exchange get a goodie, the goodie being a public announcement of an investigation into his primary or one of his primary political rivals in the 2020 election.
All right, let me stop you right there. Since, in fact, the money was eventually delivered, and since no announcement of an investigation into Joe Biden or the 2016 election took place, which is the Republican argument, how does that fit with the Constitution?
If we think about why we want to confine the power of the presidency, it's about the sense of the president that he has the ability to abuse the office, even if he doesn't succeed in abusing the office. You want whoever we want as Americans, whoever's in that office to say, wait a minute, I might get a speeding ticket if I blow through this speed limit here, which would be using the office for myself, just like in the criminal context, an attempted robbery, attempted bribery, attempted murder. Attempts are a basis for putting someone in jail, I mean, which is a loss of liberty. It's quite serious. Here we really are talking about someone losing their job. And so attempting to basically morph or distort the confines of that office for your own personal gain in our regular everyday lives. If we abuse our office, if we, you know, take some $50 bill from the cash register, we might lose our job. And why? Because if the store tolerates people stealing from the cash register, eventually the store cannot sustain itself and will close. And that's the idea of American democracy. If we don't keep each branch within their, basically within their sandbox, that's how I tell it to my students. If there aren't limits on that power, then eventually what we understand as American democracy and what we enjoy, that is individual liberties and freedoms, by having a limited accountable government, that store could close as well. And that's really the concern amongst constitutional scholars like myself. Not so much what happens to this man, but what happens to the structure of our Constitution.
What about the second article of impeachment? And that has to do with the Congress itself.
So the second article of impeachment is obstruction of Congress, as distinct from obstruction of justice. So we heard a lot about obstruction of justice with the Mueller report. Here we're talking about obstruction of the United States Congress. But it's the same concept of checks and balances and a system of separated powers, the idea being every branch gets their papers graded by the other two branches. How does the Congress grade the president's papers? It's very, very clear in the Constitution. It has the sole, the House of Representatives, has the, quote, sole power of impeachment. This is clear as a bell, right? This is, you know, the Constitution's an old document. There's a lot of vague parts of it, a lot of parts that are not spelled out. The impeachment clause is not one of them. It's very, very clear. So for Congress to be able to pull that lever of oversight, it needs facts. It needs to know what actually happened. And so to gather those facts, it goes to people who worked in the administration and says, listen, we need your testimony. We need documents. This president, through his White House counsel, has taken the position that any compliance with these subpoenas would be improper, not what he wants. And Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, has suggested that the impeachment process itself is unconstitutional. So they've stonewalled the Congress completely. That's the basis for the obstruction charge. And there's a little bit of confusion here. There's a difference between total immunity and a privilege. So historically, presidents do have executive privilege. The way that works is a witness, Don McGahn, former White House counsel, would go to Congress and say, listen, these are topics I cannot answer because they're privileged. That's different from saying, I don't have to show up at all. Immunities are very narrow. The president himself does not have absolute immunity from subpoenas. We know that because Richard Nixon lost that argument in the Supreme Court. Bill Clinton lost that argument in the Supreme Court. So it's Donald Trump's position that not just himself, but anyone who worked for him have complete immunity. That's the problem that makes it an obstruction of Congress. Because if Congress can't work with the other two branches, then it basically becomes, you know, not a functioning branch anymore, and the office of the president has unlimited power.
Well, then explain to me, if you can, how and why Republicans continue to say this whole process is unconstitutional.
You know, Diane, that's a great question, and there isn't a good answer for that. My colleague at CBS, legal analyst Jonathan Turley, was the Republican witness on that very question. And he admitted that abuse of power, the first article, is a basis for impeaching a president. His position was it's going too fast. We need more facts. But no scholar, no constitutional scholar has come out and said the process itself is unconstitutional. And that would make no sense because it's clear as day in the Constitution. And I think what we're talking about here is this problem we're having in 2019 with what's a fact and what's not a fact. That one way to amass power over large populations is to promote false narratives. People get confused. They don't know what's real, what's not real. And it's not just a matter of fact, but a matter of law. The American public are hearing a lot of things from people in office, in addition to what we hear on the internet, what Vladimir Putin, for example, has planted, false narratives. Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election. Therefore, the president was legitimate in withholding aid. That is false. That's factually false. But people these days, understandably, have a difficult time understanding what's real, what's not. I mean, that's why I wrote this book on the Constitution, frankly. I never planned to write the book called How to Read the Constitution and Why, so people can have their own set of tools to make their own decisions as to what their rights are under the Constitution.
The Republicans urged Democrats and proclaimed in these hearings that what Democrats should have done was to go through the courts to gain the upper hand on these subpoenas that were issued, but then totally denied. Would that have made more sense?
You know, I have written a piece on this. It was in The Atlantic, in which I did make the argument that it would have been prudent for the Democrats to go to the federal courts and move to compel every single one of these subpoenas for a couple of reasons. One is that you can ask for expedited review. You can ask for what's called a preliminary injunction and say, listen, we have impeachment going on. We need a ruling right away. I'm confident, and we've seen it already with a couple decisions, one back in 2008 regarding the Harriet Myers incident with the firing of the U.S. attorneys under George Bush. John Bates, a federal judge, said there's no such thing as complete immunity for people who worked in the White House. That is established precedent. So I believe that the Democrats could have gotten essentially a series of federal court decisions backing up their right for this documentation.
Federal court decisions, but then would those likely have been appealed all the way to the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. I think they would be appealed. This president has appealed, you know, all of these challenges to the scope of his power. So that's the counter argument. And, you know, there's something that in federal court, there's a rule called Rule 11, which is basically an honesty rule, a good faith rule. There are limits on the ability for lawyers to make arguments that are frivolous. And frankly, I think this argument that there's complete immunity for witnesses is really a frivolous argument. The flip side of that as well is if the Republicans were so interested, or the White House was so interested in getting the federal courts to kind of resolve a gray area, if we accept for the sake of argument that there's gray area here, which there isn't, the Republicans or the White House could have gone to the courts as well and asked for what's called a declaratory judgment and said, listen, we're confused. Courts, please clarify. The White House could have said, do we need to respond? So it goes both ways. And of course, we heard, I think it was yesterday or maybe it was today, Mitch McConnell say to Fox News that he is going to cooperate in lockstep with the White House counsel. So that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. In the House, there's going to be complete non-cooperation with the Congress, not a single document. But in the Senate, essentially the Senate works for the White House. That's a blurring of the three branches of government in a way that's deeply troubling as a matter, as I said, of the separation of powers. There's no Republicans and Democrats in the Constitution. There's the Constitution and the people. That's how the process works. And by stonewalling the House of Representatives, the White House has basically kept the full facts from the American people. It's duping regular people, not so much the people in Congress that have this oversight authority in the Constitution. It's you, me, our neighbors, our coworkers that should hear from Secretary of State Pompeo, that should be hearing from Rudy Giuliani, that should be hearing from John Bolton, these people that had firsthand knowledge of what was going on with the president. It's a little hypocritical, quite hypocritical, to say, oh, there's not enough facts here. But by the way, we're backing the president's refusal to actually give the facts. I mean, Gordon Sondland testified, listen, I really would love to have my emails that when I was working there, I don't have them. And it's making it hard for me to fully answer the questions. And there's nothing in those emails that would be protected as a matter of national security. That's just an example of someone who told the American public, I can't give you full facts because the White House won't give me access to my own records.
Now, a quick break. When we come back, more from Professor of Law, Kimberly Whaley.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Kimberly Whaley. She is the author of the book, How to Read the Constitution and Why. Professor Whaley, you are a professor of constitutional law. You've written a book titled, How to Read the Constitution and Why. And you are here saying that your belief is that the Constitution is not being adhered to as far as these rules of impeachment go. You, perhaps as well as I, saw constitutional lawyers testifying before Congress, and their status was somehow, two of them, their status was somehow impeached because each had given monies to the Democratic Party or Democratic candidates. Are you in that same position?
No, actually, I don't have that record. I was on the Whitewater team. I worked for Kenneth Starr. So I actually participated in the investigation, and which ultimately led to an impeachment of a Democratic president the last round. So I have been portrayed by some as anti-Trump. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and was on tap to do a graduation speech at my small girls' private high school, and I was disinvited because my book is somehow too political. And what I tell people is, unfortunately, in this moment, to be pro-Constitution does clash with this particular president. I don't hear anyone from the Republican side making the argument that what this president is doing is consistent with the separation of powers, with the rule of law, with an accountable government. I haven't heard anyone say it's okay to ask a foreign government to interfere in an election in order to basically make it more likely to retain power. We're in an environment where a team mentality, my team at all costs, you know, I'm a Mets fan till I die. I'm a Republican till I die. I'm on that team. Or I'm on the other team, you know, a Democratic team. That has become more important, or at least more in the forefront of people's sense of what matters than the Constitution itself. The analogy I use, I mentioned this in the book, is as if the Constitution is a bridge over a rushing, very dangerous river. And it's an old bridge. It's 230-something years old. And sometimes on top of the bridge, there'll be police officers in blue uniforms, and they're really favorable to cars that are blue. And sometimes there are people in red uniforms, and they don't give tickets to cars that are red. They only ticket the blue cars. So the people in the blue cars really get angry with the red uniformed officers. The people in the red cars get really angry with the blue uniformed officers. And then they start getting angry with each other. The blue car people don't like the red car people, and they're entrenched in their team. Meanwhile, the bridge is corroding. The grouting is falling apart. It needs to be sustained. It needs attention. It needs more focus than what we're worrying about with who's directing traffic on the bridge. And one day, and we've seen this as a matter of infrastructure, the bridge collapses. When the bridge collapses, everyone goes down with the bridge. The blue uniformed cops, the red uniformed cops, the blue cars, the red cars, everyone goes down with the bridge. And this is the point that I try to make in the book and that I've tried to make in my public statements. We as Americans need to pay attention to the bridge. And what the framers understood is that it's the structure of the bridge that protects individual rights. So there was no Bill of Rights in the original Constitution. The idea is if you give tickets for speeding to the president, then the presidency cannot arbitrarily bully regular people based on arbitrary traits, based on your skin color, based on your religion, based on your politics. But if that office doesn't have limits, then what happens is regular people have their individual rights violated by a bullying government. That's what's at stake right now. And in 5-10 years, if we let our structure of government fall apart, which has happened historically with other democracies, we're not immune from this, then it's too late to put that toothpaste back in the tube.
Tell me how the Senate trial works. Will additional witnesses be called, subpoenaed? Will that subpoena carry more weight than those subpoenas issued by the House Intelligence and the House Judiciary Committees?
So we've heard a lot about fairness in the House, particularly with respect to the president. It has not been unfair, frankly, because he did have an opportunity last week to call witnesses prior to the articles being issued. If you think of this like a grand jury proceeding,
right?
You can be indicted. You don't get to bring any lawyers into the grand jury. You don't get to bring witnesses into the grand jury. That's all done in secret. So this president got more process than a regular person gets that could put them in jail. He got more process to keep his job. So that's number one. Democrats were in charge of the rules because they're the majority. When it goes to the Senate, Republicans are in charge of the rules because they're the majority. That's just the way it goes. It is unclear what will happen in the Senate. My understanding, and I don't have firsthand knowledge, is that there's a bit of a debate between Senate Republicans who want to keep it short and sweet, not call witnesses. I think on the facts, we haven't seen a real counter narrative on the facts. You start calling fact witnesses, it's probably not going to go well for the president, or we would have heard from them. And then we hear the White House who wants a full-throated defense. This is a perfect call. No
one. Then would there be cross-examination if those witnesses were called that the president wanted?
Right. I think the president's defense would be what we saw a little bit in the last couple of days. Hunter Biden's a bad person.
Right. Totally shifting.
And frankly, as someone who's had family, close family with substance abuse problems, that was very hard to watch. That is not a joke. That's a disease. That was despicable, frankly, to and irrelevant. But I think the defense would be, let's call the whistleblower, let's call Hunter Biden, et cetera. But then the Democrats will say, okay, you want to open this up? We want to hear from John Bolton. We want to hear from Pompeo. We want to hear from Rick Perry, all of these top aides. And then I think politically it gets hard for the Senate to say, our witnesses, but not your witnesses.
So would there be negotiation before the Senate trial begins, or do Republicans in the Senate simply have the word?
Well, there will be, as we saw in the House, a resolution, a Senate resolution, setting forth the process for how the Senate trial will go. That's my expectation. That's what happened with Bill Clinton. The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court presides over
presiding.
That process. But it's not a court of law. So whether his rulings stick, how much the Republican majority can overrule his rulings, we could see the Republican majority say, we move to dismiss. We move to basically, you know, wipe out the articles of impeachment on these grounds that they're unconstitutional. You know, this is uncharted territory, except to the extent to which I think historically we probably saw more independent thought from politicians on both sides of the aisle. Here, with this particular president, it's all in for Donald Trump, or you get primaried and you lose your seat. So we don't have a Republican caucus that are actually exercising independent judgment based on the facts with respect to what's best for their constituents. It's about retaining power, essentially. So I don't have a lot of confidence that this process is going to unfold in a way that really gets to the heart of what happened and what to do about it.
And your greatest worry, from what you've said, is the damage to the Constitution itself.
Exactly. I mean, you think about the war powers, for example, right? So Congress has the power to declare war. It's essentially not enforced that for many, many decades. So now the president sends troops in without Congress even being part of it. We have to understand, if we don't enforce the Constitution, get out your black Sharpie and cross it out. The Emoluments Clause is another example. We might as well cross that out because Congress has not enforced that. If we have a presidency that's checked through impeachment, but a Republican majority in the Senate willing to essentially say there's no facts that would put us in a position where we'll acknowledge that prerogative of Congress, then impeachment goes out the window. And if impeachment, we cross that out, what's left? We could use the courts to prosecute potential crimes in the White House, but we know from the OLC memo and the Mueller report that the Department of Justice won't prosecute. So that takes two legs of the three-legged stool out. Congress is out because the impeachment power is not going to be enforced, regardless of how bad things get. Courts are out because DOJ has internally decided we won't prosecute. So those are two branches. Guess what we're left with? A single branch of government. That's a monarchy. And as I said, even if you like this president, that mantle of power gets passed on to the next president and the next president.
You've also voiced concern specifically about Rudolph Giuliani.
That is also an important story, an important point to put a pin in. Prior to writing this book that is for regular people, I mean, it talks about theory. It's not an easy beach read. It's accurate. I did a lot of scholarship, actually, on the Constitution and how much it applies to private parties. So imagine you go to the airport and TSA pats you down. If that TSA worker is paid by the federal government, you could sue them for a constitutional violation if that occurs. If that TSA worker happens to be a private contractor, there's no constitutional oversight. So it's a bit of a blind spot when we have contracts for contractors. Rudy Giuliani is a private
contractor.
Person. He's not even, I think, on the federal payroll. There's not even a contract that manages how his power is, you know, overseen. We also have an appointments clause that requires the Senate to give advice and consent to appointments. So anybody who's in the president's cabinet, anybody with secretary of in their name, has to be approved by the Senate. And the idea is the framers are like, we want the American public, through their representatives, to decide whether we like that person having that much power. Guess what's happened here? Rudy Giuliani, private party, basically was given authority to implement Ukrainian foreign policy. It's outsourcing the State Department. Not only is he not bound by the Constitution, he wasn't appointed, didn't go through Senate confirmation. He's not bound by the Freedom of Information Act. If he has records to a Freedom of Information Act request that American public or the press might want to know, doesn't have to respond. Ethics rules, background checks, all of these laws that have developed for many years to make sure public officials, people with power, the power of the people, exercise that power with integrity, none of them apply to Rudy Giuliani. That's really serious. We're hearing a lot upset about the FBI, you know, whether the FBI is corrupt, et cetera. But that's all what we're witnessing is oversight. We're witnessing, you know, the power of government overseeing people who are within the federal bureaucracy in the FBI to make sure they do their job the way they should. Rudy Giuliani, he's out on a limb. So the other thing we're tolerating in this moment, president comes into office, taps his or her personal buddies and says, I'm not going to bother appointing anybody. You all do the work of the government. You're not accountable at all to the people. You're accountable to me personally. And what I want you to do is use that power so that I stay in power. Do it for me, not for the American people, and I'll reward you with more power. That's the framers understood this, Diane. The framers got this because they fled a monarchy.
So, in fact, what you're saying is that impeachment itself may be a victim of what we're seeing, that the right of the Congress to hold the president accountable and to say, you have broken the laws set out by our founding fathers, may be the victim of this process.
Yes. If impeachment is the way the Congress checks the presidency, yeah, I think that is a victim. And the framers did talk about not having an impeachment clause. And there was an argument made that, well, we'll just wait for the next election. If people don't like the president, wait for the next election. And then even people who adhered to that view were persuaded that we need something else. Because what if the power is abused for purposes of the next election? That's not going to fix it. You know, so they added impeachment specifically to ensure a president cannot use the power to stay in office by basically fixing an election. So if we're tolerating that in this moment, we have to understand as Americans, we are tolerating a presidency where when we go to the polls in the future and we see how the results are, we cannot be confident that those results are pure representations of what the will of the people are, because we will have tolerated the idea of the massive power of the presidency being used behind the scenes. This president got caught behind the scenes to basically distort the outcome of that election.
This president has said that he could be elected for a third or a fourth or a fifth term.
Mike Huckabee is, it was reported, I think, yesterday that that's the position that he's promoting on behalf of the president, that somehow the, quote, abuse, unquote, those are my words, but of this president from the Democrats would justify violating that part of the Constitution, which limits the presidency to two terms. It's really, really serious stuff. And it's hard to capture the American public's sort of interest in that meta problem. People care about a lot of issues. They care about healthcare. They care about income inequality. They care about taking care of their families. They care about climate change, very serious. If we do not have an accountable government, if we essentially allow the executive branch to morph into something closer to a dictatorship where it's about whatever that person wants, all of the rest of those issues go by the wayside. This is the fulcrum. This is the center. This is the heart of everything else we care about as Americans. If we lose this, it's a cascade. And there's no guarantee that any of us would be sort of somehow slip through the cracks with a government that could arbitrarily snoop on you, arbitrarily arrest you, arbitrarily retaliate based on your point of view. These are the kinds of protections we take for granted. They're only there because there's a piece of paper, what we call the Constitution, that has been enforced.
Professor Whaley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diana. It was a real honor to be here.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yurev-Livker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. It's been a rough week. I'm Diane Reams.